Money FM 89.3, the best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Now defunct Japanese crypto exchange Mt. Gox was the face of Bitcoin. It processed over 70% of Bitcoin transactions before it collapsed in 2014, saying it had lost nearly all the 850,000 Bitcoins from its accounts. Mark Capellas, former CEO of Mt. Gox, is my guest today. Great to meet you, Mark. Welcome to Singapore.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
You know, they say hindsight is 2020. If you could go back in time, Mark, what is the one thing that you would do differently with Mt. Gox?
There are actually quite a few things, but the main thing I've been missing with Mt. Gox actually is to have more allies and people working with me, especially at the beginning, because running a Bitcoin exchange was a lot more complex than I expected at the beginning. It was a new kind of business. There was no exchanges before Mt. Gox, actually, so there's been a lot of things that we had to find out or learn on the way.
So more allies to have worked with you. You don't regret anything else besides that?
Of course, there are different other ways I would have run things differently. And knowing that Mt. Gox was hacked and how it was hacked, now that we know exactly how it happened, I would have been able to add more protections and systems to avoid this kind of attacks. I do believe, however, that at the time, we didn't have the technology yet to do this kind of protections. Wallet encryption, cold wallets, a lot of things were not existing yet. And we actually, with Mt. Gox, helped a lot on the innovation on this sector. So, yeah, there's things that we could have done if we had the technology today. And I don't think that Mt. Gox running today would have run into the same kind of issues we ran at the time. But we are really at the beginning of this whole cryptocurrency period back then.
You know, I'm very mindful that many different stakeholders might be listening and watching this interview. Mm-hmm. Is it true that the trustee of Mt. Gox will rehabilitate the victims with Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash, not fiat?
It depends on the victim's choice. So everyone who registered with the trustee had the option to choose if they want to receive their claims as cash or as Bitcoins or Bitcoin Cash. And the trustee will distribute for people who only had cash, of course, cash, but for people who had Bitcoin with Mt. Gox, they will be able to receive repayments in Bitcoin. I know the cash payments already started since the end of last year. I understand that the Bitcoin payments should start soon. So we should start seeing Bitcoins coming from Mt. Gox in the coming days or weeks.
And can you clarify if the cash value will be based on the amount of Bitcoin as valued on the day that, you know, Mt. Gox declared bankruptcy, or is it a different permutation?
Initially, in the bankruptcy process, the value was supposed to be based on the value at the date of the bankruptcy, which was about one Bitcoin for $500. The thing is, the price of Bitcoin increased 100-fold, even more than that since then. So it meant that the repayment amounts would have been very low compared to the assets held by Mt. Gox. So we changed back in 2018 the bankruptcy process to something called the civil rehabilitation process, which is a slightly different process under Japanese law that allows claims in Bitcoins to be distributed as Bitcoins and ensures that all the assets will go to the former customers of Mt. Gox.
Given this new rehabilitation process, do you anticipate any excess funds at all?
All the funds that are held by Mt. Gox will be distributed to the creditors. There will be nothing remaining at the end. And I am not due to receive anything from this.
Who are Mt. Gox's shareholders as it stands?
Mt. Gox, at the time of bankruptcy, had only two shareholders. There was Jed McCaleb, who hold 12% of the shares, and myself through the TBAN company, which was a company holding Mt. Gox, which held 88% of Mt. Gox. And because I hold 100% of TBAN, that would make me the owner of 88% of Mt. Gox.
So just to clarify, given the new rehabilitation process, you don't expect that any proceeds will go to any of the shareholders, you or Jed, right?
Exactly. All the assets held by Mongox, all the bitcoins, all the cash will be distributed to the creditors. There will not be a single yen or cent distributed to shareholders, or not a single bitcoin.
Mark, what does the forensic investigation tell us about where the bitcoins went?
So one thing that's really important to understand is that Mongox, as one of the very first exchanges and managing 70% of the trading volume of Bitcoin, as you said, had a lot of Bitcoin transactions. We handled between 2,000 to 10,000 transactions a day on the blockchain, which meant that there was a very large amount of data to be analyzed. And it took about 2 years from the bankruptcy for investigators working full-time to get to the end of this. But we found out that there were unauthorized transfers from Mongox to third-party wallets, which were tracked and identified to an individual named Alexander Vinik, who is a Russian national. And when we found out about this, because he was in Russia, there was nothing we could do at the time. We worked with the U.S. law enforcement. U.S. law enforcement asked us to stay undercover, like don't talk about this to anyone until they could maybe get a chance to do something. Because while Alexander Vinik is in Russia, there's nothing we can do. But maybe he will go out of the country. And they did manage to arrest him when he was on holidays in Greece. So the arrest happened in 2017, around July, I believe. And Alexander Vinik went to Greece. He was arrested there. The U.S. the U.S. started to make the process to get him sent to the U.S. Somehow, Russia also tried to get him sent to Russia. So there was a kind of a war between U.S. and Russia on how to get Alexander Vinik out of Greece. And Greece, being a European country, typically would tend to prefer returning a citizen to their own country because that's historically how it's done. But it was very clear that Alexander Vinik returning to Russia wouldn't face any punishment for his crimes. And around that time, France also came in and wanted to get Alexander Vinik arrested for a completely different case. It was a case of ransomware. So Alexander Vinik was actually sent to France because for Greece, France being also in Europe, it was much easier to do. He was tried, found guilty, spent a few years in France in jail. And in the meantime, there was the Russian-Ukraine war, which meant that it was no question anymore to send Vinik back to Russia. And when Vinik was freed in France, he was sent back to Greece. And the same day, he was in a plane to the US. So right now, he's in the US in custody, and he is scheduled to be tried in September of this year. And I do believe this trial is likely to give us more information, so I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you very much for that, you know, in-depth explanation of the history leading up to where we are presently in terms of the trail of the missing Bitcoin. You're listening to Money FM 89.3. My very special guest today is the former CEO of Mt. Gox, Mark Capellas. I'm Michelle Martin. Mark, at the time you took over Mt. Gox from founder Jed McCaleb, it was already $50,000 in debt. When was security starting to be an issue for you at Mt. Gox? You often say, I'm an engineer. When did you start to sense something was off?
Actually, when I took over Mongox, it was a little bit more than that in debt, because there was $50,000 missing, but there was also 80,000 bitcoins missing. But at the same time, the contract I signed before knowing about this with Jed McCaleb prevented me from doing anything, and I was liable for anything happening to Jed. So at the time, I believed that my only option was to go with it and try to do something with the situation. Based on what I know today, and if I had a lawyer at the time, we would most likely just have said that the contract is not valid because the exchange is not as described and so on. But I was only like 24 at the time, I believe, or 25. I was very young, and I didn't have the experience I have today. So that's one thing I saw that could have been done differently. But the thing is, I decided to go with it at the time. I immediately knew that there were issues with Mt. Gox. The first 3 months, so basically I took over in March of 2011 and until June, when there was a very large attack and I had to take offline the whole system, there were actually quite a few security issues I had to solve, mostly very basic things, like we had an issue that's called rest condition, where if someone sends multiple requests at the same time, for example, to withdraw Bitcoins, typically when you withdraw Bitcoins from an exchange, your balance will be checked. If you have enough, then it will be deducted and the amount will be sent to you. But if you make, for example, 2 requests at the same time, you can cause the check to happen before the deduction is done on both requests at the same time, which means like you have 100 Bitcoins, you request withdraw 100 Bitcoins twice, and the system will first check. It will see both times that you have 100 Bitcoin. Then it will deduct 100, so we'll get to zero and then minus 100 and send you the Bitcoin. So that's a very typical, what you call race condition, where 2 requests basically race against each other. That was one of the things I found in the very early Mt. Gox system I inherited at the time, which I could solve very easily by setting up what we call a lock, that one request cannot run at the same time as another request. So that was a very easy fix. But at the same time, it showed the level of care that was given by JED to the initial system was very low. My priority was to get Mt. Gox to be moved to something better. The only issue I had with this is that it would take time. Around the same time, I took over Mt. Gox in March 2011, about the 2 or the 3. On the 10-11, we had a very large earthquake in Japan. Right after that, to move my office. I mean, there was a lot of things happening at the time that meant I couldn't do the things I wanted to do. But in June, when we had this big hack that fortunately didn't result in any large loss, but was very visible, I took the opportunity to just take everything offline and spend time to focus on rewriting the whole system from the ground up, which took about 1.5 weeks. It allowed me to, from that point, go from something clean.
What was a cold wallet to hot wallet setup?
When I took over Mt. Gox, actually back in 2011, there was no cold wallet because the notion of cold wallet didn't exist yet in cryptocurrencies. That's something actually we worked with some experts in the Bitcoin community, a way to store Bitcoins offline, either on paper or secure device. Between June and September of 2011, actually, Mt. Gox changed a lot of things in the way we store Bitcoins. We added encryption protocols on the wallet. So the hot wallet, actually Bitcoin, the Bitcoin software itself didn't have any encryption facilities at the time. So we had to write this specifically for Mt. Gox and create a lot of innovation on this part too. At the same time, we started creating cold wallets, I think in June, because the hack brought up also the high risk there is to see Bitcoins disappear. Mm-hmm. We moved forward with this step by step. And actually, it's thanks to the cold wallets we created at the time that Mt. Gox, at the time of bankruptcy, still had 200,000 Bitcoins, which is how today Mt. Gox is returning customers value higher than their initial investment.
Great to know. When you think about how technology has evolved, what do you think are the challenges of keeping crypto exchanges secure today?
Well, actually, cryptocurrencies are still a very new technology, and there is a very complex balance to be taken between convenience and security. Because when we try to improve security, we tend to lose on the convenience side. So, for example, someone wants to store their cryptocurrency in a secure way, we have to set up either a cold wallet or even buy a hardware wallet. Typically, when they set up their wallet, the system will ask them to write down 24 words on paper to make sure that the wallet is stored in a fully secure way. A lot of people tend to either misplace this paper or they will take a picture of it with a mobile phone, which actually is a very bad thing to do because the whole idea of writing these words on paper is to make sure it's kept fully offline. So it's actually a very difficult thing right now to store cryptocurrencies securely. I do think there will be ways in the future to solve this, to make it more convenient to go start with crypto. That's something I'm also trying to think about and find solutions for. People who have lower values, like only storing a small amount of money and so on in crypto, maybe we'll find it easier to just store this with an exchange despite the risks, because it's only a small amount. It's not a big deal if it's lost. But anyone who has large amounts of money will have a lot more trouble to find a secure way of storing cryptocurrencies.
So what should investors with significant amounts of money looking to self-custody rather than outsourcing it to an exchange, what can they do to prevent themselves from being hacked?
The best way, especially for larger investors to store cryptocurrencies, would be to go to a custody company, because they won't be doing self-custody, but at the same time, custody companies come with insurance, which means that in case of hacks, the value of the stored assets can be returned. While self-custody might be a better idea for like private investors, as it has a much lower cost, but there is no insurance. Storing your gold bars under your pillow is, there are reasons why we don't do this today, is because there are still a lot of risks involved, but it might still work depending on the kind of amounts involved. So okay, for self-custody, typically the best way to do it is to use a hardware wallet. You will end with a piece of paper with very important words that needs to be kept offline. And the best way to do this is to put it into an opaque envelope in the bank safe. Or if you are very sure of your memory, you can also try to memorize the words. Another thing that can be important to do is to make two or three copies of this piece of paper in case there is a fire or something in your bank. Because if you lose the paper and your hardware wallet, there won't be any way to recover your assets.
Mark Capellas is one of the most recognized names in the crypto story and the evolution of Bitcoin. As we see the story evolving, Mark, what do you think of SBF's 25-year sentence for his part in the fall of FTX?
For this sentence, actually, I think it's quite low compared to what happened. FTX, unlike Mongox, is a case of gross mismanagement and embezzlement. For the record, I was also accused of embezzlement, but found innocent of it in Japan, which is a country where you have a 99% conviction rate. So it was a really difficult and long, happy battle to get there. But unlike SBF, I didn't buy houses with the customer's money or invest into politicians or anything like that. So when looking at both cases, there can be some parallels made. It's both cases, a large exchange that went into bankruptcy, but it's where the comparison stops. Seeing how what we learned today about how FTX was managed, like the lack of accounting records, the approval process over Slack with emojis and a lot of things like that, there was clearly a very large issue within FTX. And while I understand Sam Bankman-Fried came from a very nice university, at the same time, he was not a business manager. I can imagine how things went the way they went, but clearly, he didn't understand the kind of responsibilities he had at the time. And when we hear 25 years, I do understand in the US that it will be actually slightly lower than that. There are different ways, especially for nonviolent crimes, criminals to get reductions. So it could be as low, from what I read online, as 15 years, which is both long because it's right around 30 years old, kind of the golden years you can spend in life. But at the same time, he caused damage to a very large number of people worldwide. I do not believe that at this point he really feels bad about the way things happen, at least as far as I can see. He only feels bad about himself right now.
You know, you mentioned you've been acquitted on embezzlement. you've been acquitted on a number of charges, including embezzlement, but you have been found guilty of falsifying data by a Japanese court in 2019. Are you still fighting that? What was falsified? What were you trying to do?
It's a little bit of a complex situation because it's more an issue of the legal definition of falsifying records rather than the did I do something or did I not do something. And the way the court is seeing things is that Mt. Gox was missing bitcoins. It was actually missing bitcoins from day one. But the balance shown to customers showed their full amount. So as far as Mt. Gox was concerned, and as far as I'm concerned, I assumed the amount we showed to customers was how much we owe them. In which case, if a customer makes a withdrawal request, we need to respond to this request and send them the amount specified. But the prosecutors used a specific rule in Japanese law, which claims that the amounts we showed should have been representative of how much bitcoins Mt. Gox actually held on behalf of those customers, and as such, that the balance we showed them was false and not should have reflected basically the bitcoins that were stolen. So that's a very complex thing. I was accused initially of this, which is actually a lower charge compared to the corporate embezzlement, because the jail sentences in Japan for the falsification record is up to 5 years. The corporate embezzlement is up to 10 years with a lot more weight on it. And I was accused of also breach of trust, which also comes with a 10 years sentence. So we really focused on the embezzlement breach of trust for the defense strategy, which we all got cleared, but we couldn't get the last part, the falsification of record, cleared.
For a number of years, a lot of anger was targeted towards you from the creditors. How has this impacted your personal journey? Not just your personal legal journey, but your personal journey through life?
Actually, it impacted things a lot for me because even after the Mt. Gox bankruptcy, I still tried to get the remaining businesses, the hosting business I was doing since before Mt. Gox, still running, so we could limit the hold cost and number of companies going bankrupt. But that wasn't possible. In the end, the parent company, Tibman Hassel, had to file for bankruptcy about a year later because of all the activity around Mt. Gox. And I mean, many creditors made it a personal mission to try to stop anything I was doing at the time, which I can understand. I did receive also a lot of death threats against me, my cat too, which actually turned out many, many years later, the person who sent, there was this person that said they actually would kill and eat my cat. That person, 3 or 4 years later, sent me a message to say that they were sorry they sent that. And they really sent this because of the anger on the situation at the time. I mean, I understand people can say or do things when they are angry. So I understood that, but still that was a very dark situation at the time. When Tibban went to bankruptcy, there wasn't much I could do. I ended up being arrested myself because, I mean, the main reason I was arrested in the end was that Japanese law enforcement typically needs to give a terminating point, especially for a case like Mt. Gox, which was all over the media. They had to show that they arrested the bad guy and that the case was closed. So my arrest was very well covered by all the media. Actually, the day before the arrest, the street in front of my home was filled with journalists who were told by the police I would be arrested the next day and came to take pictures. I spent, after being arrested, almost 1 year in detention pending trial. With all the investigation and everything going on, it was actually quite difficult to defend myself like this because this is a case where there's a lot of data. My lawyer sent me all the accounting records, which were about 20,000 pages of paper because in Japanese jail, I don't have access to any computer, phone, or anything. I only had paper, and I did manage to get a calculator, but that was the whole extent of what I had at the time. And the initial embezzlement case was very simple because it was based on the last financial year of Mongox. Mongox, according to the prosecution, had made about $12 million of profit, revenue, sorry, spent $16 million. So whatever the difference is came from customer money and shouldn't have been spent. But I was able to prove using that calculator that there was at least $5.5 million of income they didn't account for. And that was just enough to show that the charges were wrong. Actually, after I went out, I went through the whole calculation with my computer and was able to show that were actually more than $40 million US dollars of revenue generated in the last year alone. So that was a very complex situation at the time. But even after being freed on bail, it was very difficult to find any kind of work or try to continue living, basically. So I spent most of the time, at least until 2019, when I had the verdict. So that period of time was very difficult, about 3 years of getting things moving slowly. And after 2019, I got a slightly better situation, but there was still a lot of difficulties into getting into any kind of work or doing anything because, I mean, nobody really wanted to work with me on anything. More of a technical person, so I like building things. I did find some work working with people I knew and so on. But definitely not a situation I would recommend to anyone.
Well, it helps to be a genius. I hear you have genius levels of intelligence. And it's true then that you built your case for freedom based on the calculator. That is true.
Yes, huh? That's true.
And your cat was not harmed in the process.
No, my cat actually died a few years back of... chronic disease. I did what I could for my cat and I did what I could for myself. And I also did what I could for all the Mongox customers. Mm-hmm. When I was due to receive $1 billion from Mongox, I worked on trying to get this back to distributed to all the customers. So that was back in 2017, 2018. Also, I helped some people. Anyone who wanted to contact me about the Mongox bankruptcy, I would explain how to file a claim, how to do the whole process, and so on. So I did some background work while still trying to survive. But really, I see that starting at the end of last year, we see the payments have started. I think it's the beginning of the last chapter of this very long post-bankruptcy and end of Mongox, where I can finally start to look toward the future, basically.
And when you look towards the future, I understand you have ambitions to take on new projects, to analyze, to decipher events that happen in the crypto space, to educate and to help prevent similar incidents from happening. Are you working on anything that you can share with us?
I'm still working on getting things ready. I think you probably already seen in the media about Ngox, which is a project I want to launch that would basically analyze and provide notations on any crypto projects, exchanges, coins, basically anything crypto-related to make it possible for investors who might not have the technical knowledge or the time to go through all the points that need to be analyzed for a given exchange or project. To just see all the relevant information and be able to decide how much they want to invest, what kind of risks they want to take based on reliable information.
And speaking of analyzing crypto events, Arthur Hayes anticipates the Bitcoin halving will lead to a fire sale. It might pump prices in the medium term, but directly before or after, prices could be negative, so we could see intense volatility. Do you agree with what Hayes has said?
Depends, I guess, because the main reason I see that we're having selling pressure right now and until the end of the week actually comes from the U.S. tax day, which is when people in the U.S. need to pay for all their taxes. Because we have a U.S. lot of U.S. investors in the crypto space, even at the Mongox time every year, this period of time would generate a lot of sell pressure. For the halving itself, I do think some people are maybe putting too much hope on the way it will affect the price. It's very likely that the price has already been factored in by all the investors buying in advance. Of course, Bitcoin has a huge history of always being volatile, but I do think we might see maybe a stronger sell pressure because of people who bought and don't see the price increasing as much as they had hoped. But I don't see the price moving very strongly down just yet, unless, of course, another event like an exchange being hacked or something like that happens.
What do you think of the entry of institutional money by way of the Bitcoin ETFs? Is this inevitable, this development?
Well, I think it's a very important milestone for Bitcoin because it shows that Bitcoin is starting to get more recognized, and we see like getting in the
big leagues. Okay.
Yes, big leagues, exactly. So we are seeing Bitcoin finally, after all those years, being recognized as something. But at the same time, the ETF is more about investment than giving Bitcoin a use as a payment processor or payment system. So I do think it's okay, but at the same time, I was hoping to see cryptocurrencies open more opportunities in terms of payments, as it was the dream of Satoshi Nakamoto and the whole reason why, I mean, one of the biggest reasons why Bitcoin was made in the beginning. But at the same time, we do see many other solutions, Ethereum and so on, also flourishing and opening new opportunities. So I like to look not only at Bitcoin, but at cryptocurrencies in general and see what kind of future awaits us overall.
Final question, Mark. What do you say to regulators out there? What is your hope in terms of how regulators can help with this infrastructure in the journey towards greater security?
Yes. Security is always a game of balance. Earlier, I talked about balance between security and convenience. For regulators, I think it's more of a game of balance between security and innovation. And the way we can see things, for example, in the US is that you have regulated projects, Bitcoin and so on are not regulated and are not really able to innovate as much as older projects. And at the same time, we have this system of qualified investors that can invest into more risky assets and so on. And the whole idea is to allow innovation to happen while protecting regular investors. I do think it's a good way to go because if you want innovation, you need to still keep a door open for a small part of unregulated activity. But at the same time, you want to protect regular people from being, trying to invest into something that's a lot riskier than they know about. In the end, I think, yes, knowledge, knowing what you are investing into, knowing what kind of risk you are taking is a key to making basically informed investment decisions. For regulators, I'm hoping that there will remain a small area somewhere for people to invest into innovation. Because as a tech person myself, I do believe innovation is important. But at the same time, what I went through with Mongox made it very difficult to innovate because there were absolutely no rules or anything back then. Japan went into a decision to lock out everything, so there's no more innovation possible. I don't think it's a good decision, even if it protects people. I'm really hoping to find, to see the right kind of balance out there.
Mark Appelis, former CEO of Mt. Gox. Such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure was here. Thank you very much.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio at the App Store and Google Play.